What if the most iconic character in children's literature carried traces of America's racial past in his white gloves and mischievous grin? In 1957, when Theodore Geisel created The Cat in the Hat, he drew inspiration from Annie Williams, an elegant African-American elevator operator at his publisher's Boston office. Her white gloves, knowing smile, and dignified presence found their way into a character that would captivate millions, yet most readers never questioned what those visual cues meant. This disconnect reveals something profound. We've been reading racial codes in children's books without realizing they're there. The cat emerged during the civil rights movement, embodying contradictory meanings as both entertainer and provocateur, his bow tie and gloves echoing minstrel show performers Seuss had encountered in his youth. He enters a home when adults are away, disrupts everything, then leaves, a figure that can be read as liberator or threat depending on who's watching. Understanding this complexity matters because children's literature doesn't just reflect culture. It shapes how young minds learn to see race, power, and belonging. While public outrage erupted over replacing racial slurs in Huckleberry Finn, children's books undergo constant sanitization without notice. Hugh Lofting, Dr. Doolittle, was quietly revised in 1998, removing references to skin color and Prince Bumpo's wish to be white. Roald Dahl's Oompa Loompas transformed from African pygmies to white people from fictional Loompaland. Mary Poppins lost its chapter featuring stereotypical ethnic characters. These changes happen silently, unacknowledged in new editions. This comfort with revision stems from cultural belief in childhood innocence, a concept that protects white children while leaving them unprepared for real-world bigotry. Black children face radically different treatment, arrested nearly 4 times more often for marijuana despite similar usage rates, 6 times more likely to receive prison sentences, 21 times more likely to be shot by police. Sanitizing racist classics doesn't eliminate harm. It re-encodes prejudice in subtler forms that become harder to identify and discuss, comforting white readers while failing to address fundamental biases embedded in story structures themselves. William Joyce's Oscar-winning The Fantastic Flying Books of Mr. Morris Lessmore tells the story of a hurricane survivor who finds refuge in a magical library. Though Joyce explicitly cited Hurricane Katrina as inspiration and set the story in New Orleans, French Quarter, the film erases the disaster's racial reality. Katrina killed nearly 2,000 people, most African American, with black mortality rates up to 4 times higher than whites. Yet Morris Lessmore features 0 characters of color except a briefly glimpsed Duke Ellington portrait. The idyllic library showcases 17 books by dead white men, 3 by dead white women, an exclusively white literary canon. This pattern pervades Joyce's work, where people of color either vanish or appear as exotic, silent secondary characters. Other Katrina-inspired children's literature overwhelmingly acknowledges how the storm devastated poor communities of color. The contrast reveals how nostalgia for classic literature often means nostalgia for an all-white world, where everyone else's story doesn't matter. Whitewashing, placing white faces on books about non-white characters, actively erases representation. Ursula K. Le Guin's Gud is explicitly red-brown in A Wizard of Earthsea, yet appeared white on covers for decades. When the Hunger Games film revealed Rue's brown skin, readers expressed shock despite her described satiny brown skin. They'd imagined her as white. This creates a vicious cycle. Publishers claim people of color buy fewer books, so they whitewash covers, hiding characters of color from readers who would connect with them, confirming their false assumptions. With American publishing 79-89% white, industry homogeneity prevents recognizing these biases. Whitewashed covers naturalize whiteness as default white characters never need their race mentioned. For children of color facing lower reading proficiency and fewer representative books, whitewashing teaches that heroes must be white. Visual impressions permanently alter perception. Once you've seen a character as white on a cover, that image persists. genre functions as a colorblind segregation system. In 2014, only 11% of children's books featured people of color, with just 8% by authors of color, clustered overwhelmingly in realism and historical fiction. For African American books, 34% were realism, 30% historical, and only 7% were fantasy. Native American representation mirrored this, 35% realism, 33% historical, just 4 fantasy titles. Publishing's whiteness perpetuates through poverty wage entry positions favoring family wealth, prohibitive institute fees, and clubby hiring where pedigree trumps talent. When editors unconsciously associate Black literature with history or realism, manuscripts outside these categories seem unpublishable. Lorenz Graham's Southtown was rejected because his dignified Black family seemed too American. Even his white editor required expert verification of Southern racism. This segregation implies racism exists primarily in the past, limits imaginative freedom, and reinforces patterns where non-white characters in fantasy appear as figures of fear. Walter Dean Myers stopped reading as a Black teenager because these characters, these lives, were not mine, mourning the potential person I would become, a loss too many young readers of color experience. Dismantling children's literature apartheid requires transforming how we produce, promote, and teach stories. Non-white schoolchildren outnumber books featuring non-white characters by 4-1. Personal racism operates unconsciously, while systemic racism functions as what Raymond Williams called a structure of feeling, shaping consciousness invisibly. Listen to others' experiences without dismissing what your life hasn't shown you. If you're a white editor finding a manuscript by a writer of color unrealistic, question whether this judgment stems from different life experience rather than actual flaws. Don't just teach tolerance, actually respect difference by acknowledging its reality. Listen for racecraft, linguistic sleight of hand like racial profiling instead of racist profiling. Mark whiteness explicitly in writing, identifying white characters just as you identify characters of other races, because whiteness derives power from remaining unmarked. Most importantly, buy diverse books, teach diverse books, publish diverse books, and support independent publishers like Lee and Lowe, Groundwood Books, and authors like Jerry Kraft who've carved out space for authentic storytelling despite institutional barriers. The Cat in the Hat remains fundamentally ambiguous, simultaneously threat and liberator, blackface performer and reading teacher. This reflects ongoing debates about Blackness, children's literature, and racial identity. 50 years after Nancy Lerick's landmark essay, The All-White World of Children's Books, we're still asking where the books for children of color are. Progress exists. Diverse voices have entered mainstream publishing and won major awards. Yet structural racism persists in acquisition decisions, marketing budgets, and assumptions about universal stories. Corporate sanitization, like Dr. Seuss Enterprises refusing to acknowledge stereotypes, avoids uncomfortable conversations. As Robin DiAngelo observes, a continual retreat from the discomfort of authentic racial engagement results in a perpetual cycle that works to hold racism in place. Breaking this cycle means embracing uncomfortable truths about classics while championing new voices. Every child deserves to see themselves as the hero, defeating evil wizards, inventing technology, leading rebellions, solving mysteries, saving worlds. When we expand who gets to be the protagonist, we fulfill literature's highest promise. Stories shape who we become. Every child's story matters.